Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. Presented by Belco Credit Union. Visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Hello! Yes, thank you very much. Oh, did he walk in the room? Oh, darn. Welcome. On behalf of the Tattered Cover, I'd like to take this opportunity to thank you for your support of our locally owned bookstore. We very much appreciate your business. Thank you. And thanks for coming out on this, the beginning of winter night. It's not as bad as the last time Chris was in town. If anyone was in Highlands Ranch 1 or 2 years ago, I think, in November, we had a blizzard. And still, we had a nice crowd. That's how popular he is. So, I didn't even take a few minutes to write an introduction tonight because I really feel like everyone who is here tonight knows who our guest is. Is that correct? Yes. All right. So thank you all very much for being here. We'll be doing a book. Feeling that this crowd knows the difference. This crowd, though, I did get a couple requests tonight to see if we can get Alton Brown to come. So, yeah. So, without further ado, please join me in welcoming Christopher Kimball.
It is true the weather is better. I mean, this is like, you know, Denver welcomes Chris Kimball. It's 85 degrees on Sunday, and then, you know, I'm here. Of course, I'm from New England, so this is like summer weather. Yeah, this is nothing. I mean, so, okay. So here we go. Now, what we're going to do is take a little movie. So, we're going to have to practice this. You're going to have to say, this is a complete shilling thing. So, we love America's Test Kitchen. Okay, so we're going to practice it now. Okay, we love America's Test Kitchen. Okay, that's good. Now we're going to do it again.
We love America's Test Kitchen.
People think I just go out and shop all day, so that's how I work. What I'd love to do is, I love doing Q&A, because it's actually a lot more fun for me, and some of you probably heard my speech 8 times already, so what I'd really like to do is just take questions, and I'd be happy to answer any question. You know, am I in love with Bridget on the show? No. Do we really test the recipes 50 times? Yes. Do I really hate old bloggers? No. So let's go. Let's ask some questions. Yeah. The question is, if you have canned tomatoes in a recipe, like 2 cans of 14 ounce tomatoes, how do you substitute fresh? It depends on the recipe. If it says drain the tomatoes, then you just substitute it, you know, volume by volume. The reason we say canned is most of the time fresh tomatoes in the supermarket are so bloody awful. They really have no flavor. And there are other times when we used a more cooked product because we're cooking something quickly, we want a sort of a more sauce-like thing. So fresh tomatoes, if you're doing crushed tomatoes or diced tomatoes, probably you can substitute them. But if it says more of a tomato sauce or in sauce, you probably can't substitute it. Yeah, you could. We just found that fresh tomatoes, where we come from, anyway, are, except for about 6 weeks during the year, are really awful. And canned tomatoes actually have better flavor almost all the time. So, what? Yeah, so do we. We make, you know, thousands of jars over the years of everything. But, you know, fresh tomatoes at the supermarket are just pretty much a complete loss. So, yeah.
There's a million recipes and a million cooking shows. First of all, I just got to say I'm impressed with the show. It's the most informative cooking show in the world, and I would like to know what inspired you to do this test kitchen as opposed to the everyday recipe.
You mean instead of cleavage, like on the Food Network? Hey, don't knock cleavage. I've asked Bridget and Julie about cleavage, and they're not going to go there. Well, it started back in the 70s. I've always cooked, and I could never get people. I went to a bunch of small cooking schools, and no one could ever answer my questions. You know, so I'm the world's worst student. I'm the most annoying person to have in a room because I don't let it go. And I said, you have to scald. I took a French class back in the early 70s, scalding milk to make a bechamel, right? And I said, why do you have to scald milk? It's pasteurized. It's already scalded. Oh, no, you have to scald it. Well, you don't have to scald it because there's an enzyme in fresh milk that needs to be killed. Otherwise, it won't thicken properly. And that's why you have to scald it. So I got so mad when I found out that they really didn't know what they're talking about. I mean, it weren't that they were bad cooks, but there was no science there. There was no understanding. And a lot of the stuff was just wrong. And so I decided what a great idea. I was 29 or 28. I would just go start a cooking magazine with, you know, some trust fund money I got from other people because I didn't have a trust fund. It's good to know people have trust funds, believe me. And I had about $100,000, which is a ridiculously small amount of money even then to start a magazine, and we just got started. What happened was during the 80s, I did take advertising, like everybody else, and realized, A, I hate selling advertising, and B, it just wasn't going to work for me. So in 93, I restarted the magazine without the ads, and that's when the test kitchen idea really came into focus. I said, look, I'm going to do the magazine I want. I don't care. I'm not going to do anything I don't want to do. I just want to do test kitchen work. We established a large test kitchen. Today we have 40 full-time test cooks. And I just wanted to spend, you know, sometimes we'll spend 6 weeks, really 6 weeks working on a recipe. Yeah. And so that's, you know, that's the deal. So, and I just think, you know, today it's funny, you know, up until about a year ago, all the publishers in New York, and I know most of them, they'd laugh at me. You know, they just like talking to me, this guy up in Boston and everything else. And now since the collapse of advertising and Gourmet's gone out of business, I got a call from the president of Hearst, Kathy Black, about 3 weeks ago. She said, would you mind having lunch? Gee, how's that working for you? No advertising. I said, a lot better it's working for you with advertising. So all of a sudden, I'm brilliant. So I just think, you know, whatever. So that's what we love to do. That's all we do. We love to do it. So anyway. Anybody else? Yeah, in the back.
Very, very basic question. What is a scant cup? Like flour or sugar?
Well, that's a very excellent question. What's a scant cup? You know, Fanny, I just am finishing up a huge book about the cooking of late 19th century America, including Fanny Farmer. And matter of fact, this weekend I'm giving a 12-course Victorian feast with 28 recipes cooked on a coal cook stove in the manner of 1896. And one of the things was Fanny Farmer, including, by the way, making mock turtle soup. And the first step is to boil a calf's head. And I digress. I've been doing this for 2 years now, developing these recipes. The first time I did it, Aaron McMurr, who's my test kitchen director, and I were developing the recipes. And you make a stock with a calf's head, and then you make a soup from the stock. Well, we tasted it, and it was a little, how do I put it nicely, gloppy. No, it wasn't gamey. Actually, you know, calf's head tastes just like turtle. I've made turtle soup too, but I couldn't figure out what was wrong. So I did some more research. It turns out that in the 19th century, every idiot knew that when you made mock turtle soup, the first thing you did was take the brains out of the calf's head. I had failed to do that. So anyway, what was the question again? And now front of the question. Oh, sorry. I got so caught up in my own story. I think I'm so interesting. Well, Fanny Farmer was the mother of level measurements, blah, blah, blah. Actually, that's not true. Mrs. Lincoln actually was very particular about her measurements. The problem was between 1883, when the Boston Cooking School cookbook was first published, and Fanny came up with her version in 1896, the cookware industry started introducing actual measurement cups, which then became standardized. So Fanny takes some credit, but not most of it. A scant simply means if you have a cup full, probably about a tablespoon less. And it's a terrible, I hope we don't use it, maybe we do, it's a terrible measurement because it's not precise.
Exactly.
Yeah, and you should actually weigh your flour, actually for baking, which is 5 ounces for a cup of all-purpose and 4 ounces for a cup of cake flour. By the way, the soup is, just to continue talking about brains, a garnish at that time for soups, one of them was brain balls. So we actually do remove the brains, poach them for 20 minutes, and it says in the 19th century, handle brains carefully, otherwise they turn to custard. That's true. I've had that happen. And then we make brain balls, which is some breadcrumbs and herbs and things, and then we fry them for 2 or 3 minutes. And so the mock turtle soup has brain balls as a garnish. When I serve it, what I'm going to do is not tell anybody what it is. And I'm going to wait till they, we're having, Renee Montaigne from Morning Edition will be there, Harry Smith and Maggie from CBS Early Show, some other people. We're going to serve it to them. And once it's about halfway down their throat. By the way, are you enjoying the brain balls? Yes.
I have a question that goes along with that. I assume since you're from Vermont that your all-purpose flours are northern all-purpose flours?
Yep.
Okay. Do you have any suggestions for how to obtain southern all-purpose flour? And going along with that, what do you think of Shirley O. Corker and her bake-wise and what she
cook-wise? Yeah. Well, Shirley Corker is nuts. I mean, she's one of the most entertaining people I've ever met in my life and is very knowledgeable. And Cookwise is a terrific book. I used her for years as our consultant for science. We use somebody up in the Boston area now. yeah, it's interesting. The history of that, speaking of history, is that when the railroads were built from Minnesota and other places in that area, the wheat belt, the flours were coming by railroad to the northeast. The South, however, was really in a different pattern. They were getting much lower gluten wheat, and that's what they have. The South is a tradition of cake flours or other flours that are 8 or 10%, and the flours used now, although I use King Arthur a lot personally, which is almost 12%, most of the Pillsbury Gold Medal is 10.5%, between 10 and 11%, and that's what most people use. So that's all our recipes are based on those Gold Medal and Pillsbury, which are about the same. You're right, in the South, you're going to end up with a slightly lower protein. You can lower high protein flour by adding some cornstarch. That'll bring it down. Bringing it up, I don't really know what you do. The amount of liquid, the thing you'll have to watch out for is the amount of liquid, because the amount of liquid absorbed depends upon the gluten level, the protein level of the flour. But there's no easy way to go from 8 or 9% gluten, protein content to 12. There's no easy formula for that. Yeah.
Can we move up the mountain here? I know you guys have some smaller mountains.
Okay. We also have more history, though, so... We have older buildings. Thank you very much. Yes.
There are a lot of recipes in your magazine with high altitude changes to them. Is there any chance that we could get some of those?
We've talked about it in some cookbooks. We've actually sent one of our cooks out here for 2 weeks to this area to cook, to do some work for us. That's probably a web thing, because the problem is, for the magazine, we really have to deal with the lowest common denominator in terms of our million readers. But that is, and the other thing we found is it's so inconsistent recipe to recipe. It's not like you can just say change the liquid amount in the recipe and it's done, as you know better than I do, because you've been doing this a long time. So it's really a recipe by recipe issue. So we would probably do that as part of our website, I think, probably, but not probably in the magazine. Yeah.
What is your elevation in Vermont?
2,000.
Well, first of all, when I tell you what our elevation is, you won't consider it elevation. It'll be called a speed bump. Our farm is at 800 feet, and the mountain... And I told you, and the mountain behind us is about 1,800 feet. But that's not the Green Mountains. These are the foothills of the Green Mountains. So I think the greens get up to some amazing amount, like 2,800 or 3,000. They're not mountains. Okay, yeah. Thank you.
A lot of fun doing it. But we're wondering what really happens with our comments when we send them back.
Here's how we test recipes. We pick a recipe like chocolate souffle cake. We'll find 20 or 30 recipes in cookbooks. Yes, on the web sometimes. We have a large cookbook library. We'll find five recipes that represent different ways of doing it. We'll go in and we'll cook them. We'll come up with, we'll say we like this, we didn't like that. We'll cobble together a master recipe. And then we'll go make it 40, 50, 60 more times. When we're done with that, we'll send it to a bunch of people who've signed up by email like you have. We'll send you the recipe with a long questionnaire using a survey software called SurveyMonkey, and you'll fill out the questionnaire and send it back. If you say, if 80% of you or more will say, I'll make the recipe again, it goes in the magazine. We'll also read your comments and try to improve it. If fewer than 80% say that, we'll then very carefully go through the surveys and try to make changes. We'll then send it back out. So we send some recipes out four or five times. So we sit there at that table Tuesday morning reading all the comments, and we take it very seriously. Because we don't take advertising. So if you decide our recipes don't work, I have to go back to growing potatoes, which is not really a good way to make a living in Vermont. So we take it very seriously. I mean, except for the guy who said that our chicken breast recipe was really terrible because they came out really tough. This is about 18 months ago, and we thought that was curious, so we looked at the comments, and he said, I didn't have any chicken. This is what I got to deal with. It's like you think testing recipes is easy, so I substituted shrimp. And he cooked it for 40 minutes, and it was a little tough. So my job is to figure out what idiotic things people will do. And those questionnaires, we ask you, do you substitute? Everybody substitutes ingredients. Now, if you're substituting one herb for another, fine. But, different wrong cuts of meat. Going from, shellfish and chicken, that seems kind of broad. A completely different food genus, But testing's about what you're going to do with a recipe. And the other problem is your oven may be 100 degrees off from ours. We have ours every month, all 23 ovens calibrated. Your oven may be off. I bet it's off at least 25 degrees. It's probably more. And even if you have a little, thermometer you bought at the supermarket, well, those don't work very well. So your cookware is different than ours. So getting someone to have good results in their kitchen versus a professional test kitchen, that's 90% of our effort is to figure out how to do it.
To follow up on that, do you appreciate them getting, because we always make comments, especially on the baking one, about what changes we've had to make because of the altitude. Because generally, like with the cakes and stuff, we make it twice. Once exactly like you guys say, and then once changing it so that it works better up here.
Yeah, well, we just did a big baking book, and that book we used all those comments to help do those high altitude baking. Yeah.
We were wondering what happens to all those cakes.
Well. None of the food gets thrown out. There are three levels of food. There's really good food. And the test cooks, of course, know this instantly. So they have big magic markers, and they have these big plastic takeout things, and they say Marge, Susan, Bridget, and they all take it home. And there's these big refrigerators we use just for food storage for that. So within seconds, that food disappears. It's gone. If the food's okay, it's kind of mediocre, well, they might take a little of it, but there's a lot left over, so they call the marketing department from the third floor, comes down. And all the men and women who do the direct mail and the emails and all the stuff you really hate, the continuity book clubs, they come down and get it. And if the food is really horrible, which it often is in the beginning of testing, we call accounting. They'll eat anything. And they've demonstrated it. Actually, the ultimate test is we have our CFO, Sharon Shabbat, who's been with me a very long time. She's brilliant. But she's like the world's slowest cook. So she has to like mince two cloves of garlic. It's like 18 minutes. So if she can get it done, we know they were in good shape. So, yeah.
My dad's birthday is coming up, and I was thinking of doing the Parmesan chicken cider episode.
Yep, that's a good recipe. Yep.
My oven went out. I was thinking of doing it on the grill. Should I wrap it in tinfoil and...
Don't. No, have your oven fixed. Do... have some steaks. Now, that won't work on the grill.
It's not going to work.
Well, I've done, actually, when I first came to Boston in 91 that summer, I'd only been there a couple months, we decided to take the family to Nantucket. Well, the problem was that was, I think... there was a huge hurricane or something. So all the power went out. We had to cook on, you know, over charcoal. I've actually made a blueberry cobbler on charcoal. I've baked a cake on a Weber grill. So I've done a number of things. But generally speaking, I probably would not suggest it. You should test it first. If it works, then you're fine. But yeah. Oh, God, do you want me to get me in trouble? I wrote an op-ed piece for the Times a couple of weeks ago about the closing of Gourmet and said that the world of the Internet has really changed the role of the editor and what people expect. And what I was trying to say, thank you for giving me a chance to defend myself, was that I have this great fondness for the age of the all-powerful editor like Bill Shawn at The New Yorker, who was there when I was there briefly. And because a really good editor will bring you stuff you didn't think you know you wanted. So that's why I still like The New Yorker, because I read, you know, 10,000 words about crossing Siberia, which I would not have said in a questionnaire was something I'd want to read. But the editor finds stuff for you and puts it together in a way I think that is interesting. Bill Shawn, when The New Yorker was bought in 1985 by Newhouse, Advanced Publications, and I was also there at the time, he was taken to lunch by Steve Florio, who was the publisher, and asked, gee, Mr. Shawn, how do you decide what your readers want? And Mr. Shawn says, well, I don't really care what they want. I edit for myself. Mr. Newhouse was at the next table, and Mr. Florio said, could you repeat that to Mr. Newhouse? 6 months later, Bill Shawn was gone. And I thought that was too bad, because I think there's something incredibly romantic and wonderful about that idea of someone bringing stuff to you you didn't know you wanted. That doesn't happen anymore. Now, because of the Internet, first of all, there's no barriers to entry in the Internet. The magazine business were monopolies like the newspaper business. It took you millions of dollars to get started, very hard to compete. They controlled all the advertising. Now, anybody with 2 cents can have a blog. There's a lot of choices. Some of the stuff's good. Some of it's garbage. But there's a lot of good choices out there. And so editors really have to think a lot more about what readers want, because readers can go other places very quickly. So if you don't like what's in Gourmet or Bon Appetit or My Magazine, you can click and find somebody else right away. So I think I call it media democracy. I mean, democracy is a good thing and a bad thing. I think it's a good thing. There's a lot more information out there. The bad news is that I think that notion of a strong editor is really a wonderful idea, and it all comes down to blogs. I think that's a bad thing. I think people who've actually had a lot of experience, you know, Julia Child, what would Julia Child say if you ever went out to dinner with her? The first thing she would say to the chef, you know, him or her would say, oh, where did you train, dearie? That's what she always asked. You know, she wanted to know where you trained. So, yeah, okay, I don't, you know, I could disagree with that to some extent, but she always wanted to know that you actually had some training. So I think training experience, for example, you know, Jerry Garcia played scales for 2 hours every day. You can't stand up and play Fire in the Mountain if you don't understand a lot about scales and music. I know, because I do that badly, occasionally. So I think experience counts, and it's a mixed bag. So, yeah. Yeah.
Was your mother a good cook?
Was my mother a good cook? That was good.
Well, I was born and raised on the farm, so we raised everything. We all three of us learned, my sisters and I learned how to cook from scratch with everything we had, and basically I still do.
Yeah, that's how I learned. My mother, well, let me put it like this. We always had our own food. We didn't live full-time in Vermont. We had a farm in Vermont. We had our own beef and a lot of our own vegetables. She's always had a root cellar when I grew up. A good cook might be a bit of exaggeration. It was healthy food. It was clean food. But, you know, she would, in her later years, for example, we go over for Thanksgiving, or Easter we go over. Well, no, Thanksgiving, we go over Easter. And, you know, the turkey had been in the oven for 10 hours already, and it wasn't cooked. And I'd say, could you check the turkey? Well, she had it in at like a 150. And she said, you know, Adele Davis believed in cooking foods at very low temperatures, which is true. And then she'd laugh and say, well, I haven't killed anybody yet. And I said, yes, but yet is a tenuous concept. So I cranked the oven up to 300. No, I learned actually to cook from Marie Briggs, who died many years ago. She was the town baker in our town where we still have a farm. She lived in the Yellow Farmhouse. She baked for the town and for a couple of country stores. And everything was done by hand. She cooked on a Kalamazoo wood cook stove, believe it or not. And there was the pump in the sink. And, yeah.
And you had to register your oven. I'm dating myself. But I mean, you had to cook the coal and you had to keep the temperature. And we always did. The bread came out, the pies came out.
Well, the thing. You know, I cook on wood-cooked stove in Vermont and also in Boston a lot. And it turns out that a wood-cooked stove is actually very easy to use. You know, for example, if you have a wood-cooked stove at 300 degrees, I can get it to 550 in 25 minutes. You can, just by adjusting the damper. So you can actually crank the stoves. And anyway, that's how I learned, was watching her. And on a rainy day, I would help her.
My mother can make highest danger food.
Well, that's because she actually cooked and she learned and she had a lot of experience. And also, people like Marie, she didn't have a repertoire of 500 recipes. She had a repertoire of maybe 100 recipes. And that's one of the things that doesn't happen today. People want to cook Brazilian food on Monday and Thai food Tuesday and something else on Wednesday. You know, 50 or 100 years ago, people had a very limited range of recipes and they made them over and over again. I've made baking powder biscuits 500 times, and that's when you don't need a recipe, is you made something long enough so that you know how to do it. So, yep. Does it end well for the turkey? No.
My sister-in-law came from Korea, and she didn't know anything about stuffing. And so she took the turkey, and she filled it with rice.
Oh, that's like popcorn, yeah.
The thing was, the turkey blew up,
Well, you know, that happened. That happened in 1983. A friend of mine had a small publishing house in New York on the Upper West Side, and she published, one of the authors had a recipe for turkey with popcorn stuffing. She forgot to mention you needed to pop the popcorn first. So at Thanksgiving, oven doors, and what happens is there's an explosion, and all the air rushes out, and the door opens, and then there's a vacuum in the oven, so the door slams shut. So they had to take it off the market. So it's pretty spectacular. Yeah, way in the back.
I have two questions for you. What will be on the Kimball Thanksgiving table and people's favorite food memory?
What's on our table for Thanksgiving and favorite food memory? We're really boring. I mean, Thanksgiving is the time not to go out and try something new, in my opinion. The turkey, my neighbor raises three turkeys. The names Thanksgiving, Christmas, and Easter. Easter disappeared, so we only have Thanksgiving and Christmas this year. She brings it over the day before, and then I brine it and cook it. My wife makes Parker House rolls, Brussels sprouts she loves. We have our own beets in the cellar. We use those. I certainly do mashed potatoes. I do a bunch of pies, pumpkin, pecan, apple pie. I make a trifle, which is a little unusual, but the kids like that, which is good. I make it with a chiffon cake, though, not with the biscuits. And we have, you know, make our own cranberry sauce. The neighbors, we have a bunch of neighbors over. We have about 12 or 13 people at the table. All the kids are there. Favorite food memory for me is Marie is her baking. And she used to make anadema bread, which is my favorite bread. It has molasses and cornmeal in it. And, you know, the thing about her was you'd walk in. Anybody walk in, and lots of people did, you'd always leave with three or four slices of fresh baked bread. And she always had a lot of food. So it was the center of town. And that's my food memory, is that baker and those, and the molasses cookies she used to make. And so, yeah.
Who is the elderly gentleman on Cook's Country? Is his wife aggravated with you ever?
No, that's Axel, who's a neighbor of mine. He actually, we both boil maple syrup. He does about 1,200 gallons a year. I do about 300 or 400. He taught me a lot about sugaring. He's a terrific guy. His wife is Donna. Like Donna done it again. Donna is the most, she's cheerful, happy. She thinks it's just very amusing that her husband goes on and disses her food. Or I do, excuse me. And they live right down the road. They live literally half a mile down the road from the house where we do the filming. And he's just, and matter of fact, what happens is after we film each day, we're up there about 2 weeks, the crew is renting a house down the road. They walk home, and they stop by Axel's house, and he does Canadian Club and ginger ale. So they sit there and get completely hammered every night with Axel. Axel also is the one who digs graves in town. He sells you cordwood. He does a lot of things. He's a very, very shrewd businessman. He's a very smart guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Just get on that point about the whole maple syrup back up. Do you guys ever make like maple candy or maple snow or anything like that? That would be great to teach everyone else.
something? Well, no, we just do maple syrup. Maple candy, you just have to boil till at a higher. Yeah, we did about 350 gallons this year. We have 4,000 taps going to next year. We have the perfect setup. We're the mountains right behind us. We have all the lines coming down. Nobody uses the buckets anymore for obvious reasons if you have a big operation. We have a 10-foot arch. We do use an RO, reverse osmosis, which takes some of the water out of the sap, which increases the sugar content from 2 to about 6.5%. We boil it. We put it through a finisher, which is a filter, and then into the heater to get 180 degrees to put it in the bottles. We had a very short season this year. It was only about 2 weeks because what happened was it needs to get really cold at night below freezing. And where we are, we're north-facing. It has to get up over 40 during the day to get the sap to run. So it got up to 35, 36. It never really warmed up, and then all of a sudden it got hot. So next year we're hoping for 500 or 600 gallons. It's, you know, it's the thing about sugaring is everyone has cabin fever by March up there, and everyone's getting kind of, you know, bristly. So everybody comes out of their houses and they all sit around the sap house and everyone stops by and they have a couple of beers and lunch and stuff and they boil eggs in the syrup and everything else. And so it's sort of life starts all over again. So it's, you know, it pays some of the cost of the farm, but not all. Yeah.
I'm curious what part of Vermont you're in and if you don't want to say exactly what's the closest
to you. Let's see. How much should I lie now? No. No, we're southwest Vermont. The closest is Bromley. Bromley's the closest, and Stratton's a little farther away. We're not too far from the Manchester area. We're up in the mountains. It's a little tiny town that I grew up in, and it's, you know, it's interesting. Everyone thinks about Vermont and the Northeast Kingdom as being the wild area. Where we are, there's more just open, well, it's forest, but nobody lives there. It's this huge tract of land. You can get on a horse. We have horses. And you could ride 8-10 hours and not see anything. You're just up in the middle of nowhere. Matter of fact, we ride to the next town over the mountain frequently. So it's just a wonderful part of Vermont that's kind of forgotten. You know, you have to drive 20 minutes to go to a store, but that's just fine. Yeah.
I love the new Cook's Country, and that, or the best country recipes and stuff of that nature. And I was wondering, how did you come up with that idea, or was it... I just think it's a great idea.
Cook's Country? Well, that's the food I grew up with. Cook's Country magazine we're talking about in the TV show. I really wanted to save that food because, you know, in the fancy food magazines, you don't get a lot of these kinds of recipes. And it's great food. Some of it is anyway. So I wanted to go back in and just rediscover it and put it through a test kitchen process to update it and save it. I mean, that's really what I like to do. I mean, I don't think... You know, it's a much smaller circulation than Cook's. Cook's about 1 million, and Cook's Country is about 300,000 plus. But it's the kind of food I like. And Bridget also grew up on that food, and she loves it. And so it's really great because it's food in a context. It has a beginning. It has a place it came from. It's not just a recipe. It tells a story. So just...
I have to say that I love that you do the history of food sometimes.
Yeah, it's actually really fascinating, history of food. Thanks. We'll just take one more question because we have a lot of people here. Yeah.
I'm lactose intolerant and have to shy away from a lot of things with milk in it. Is it okay to substitute soy milk into recipes?
Is it okay to substitute soy milk for milk? No. I would say rice milk is probably, in my experience, I used to publish Natural Health magazine many years ago. We got into this a lot. And rice milk tended to be the, because it doesn't have a strong flavor, first of all. And it seems to work better. But it's sort of recipe by recipe. If you're really depending on thickening power and other things, then you're sort of in trouble. If it's just going to be there for the liquid content, it's better. But I would go with rice milk rather than soy milk, probably, for both those reasons. Thank you so much for coming. It's been a real pleasure. I'd also like to, you know, Tattercover. There are two bookstores that are my favorite, Tattercover, and then there's one in the next town in Vermont, the Northshire Bookstore also. But I love independent bookstores, so thanks for coming.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fode, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Authors on Tour Live has been presented by Belco Credit Union. Belco has been serving members' financial needs since 1936. visit www.belco.org/authors.asp to learn more about how Belco can help you. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks for many more authors as we podcast Authors on Tour.